Our guest today is someone who worked very closely with late President Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam. He began life as a gold medalist from IIM Ahmedabad, went on to work with the Boston Consulting Group, but then decided to join the late president in his quest for making India great. We have today with us Srijan Pal Singh. You gave up an exciting career, you gave up the entire opportunity that you had in the world, etc., and you chose to come and work with the President of India. What is it that made you do it? What is it that attracted you towards him?
I think I chose a path which I felt and I realized that it was a path of serving the nation through the ideas and visions and actions of somebody who was my childhood hero and perhaps the childhood hero of everybody in my generation. Dr. Kalam was somebody we saw how he became the president and how happy we were to see a scientist becoming a president of India. And the opportunity to work with him, and not only work with him, but to serve the nation through being a part of his mission as an advisor, initially as an OSD and then eventually as an advisor, was not just an honor, but an opportunity. So I think...
And you were just very young. You were only 22 or something, right?
22, 23, yeah, something
22, 23. Entire range of work that you did with him, you wrote his speeches, you gave him advice on science, you gave him advice on policy, you co-authored books with him. Just take us through a day in the life of Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam. Just take us through a day of that.
So Dr. Kalam, my association with him, the first time I met him in person was as a teacher. He came to teach at IIM Ahmedabad. There's a course he came, and that's how I got acquainted with him. And I always saw the teacher in him. And I also saw that how great teachers are also great students. So if I were to say how a day began with him, the day began with a session of about 1 hour of knowledge exchange, which Dr. Kalam used to call building the knowledge platform within ourselves. I would tell him for half an hour what is happening around the world, sourced from the internet. And then for other half an hour, he will bring those magazines, which he had subscribed to. And he will tell me stories of what has been published. So I was giving him the electronic stuff, the gyan, and he was giving me the print form of the gyan. Mm-hmm. He was known as the perhaps the smartest Indian in his era. And yet he, at that age, he had the quest to learn. So I would teach him. The other thing was that Dr. Kalam was extremely particular about certain habits. So if he's in Delhi, if he's outside, the habits wouldn't happen because there'll be events. But at 3 p.m., whether it's sunny, whether it's hot, whether it's raining, whether it's winter, he would go around Das Rajaji Marg. His house was mm-hmm. 10 Rajaji Marg, and he would go around. He'll make that afternoon walk. Doesn't matter if whatever the weather is. So those kind of habits were always there. And one interesting habit was there that he always said that, you know, the real owners of any place we live are the birds and the animals out there. So he would never, ever, and I ate every lunch, dinner, breakfast with him, never start food unless the animals and the birds were fed separately. He'll start only when he's seen that.
Now let's come to your book, What Can I Give? It's obviously a memoir of your times with Dr. Kalam, etc. Lots of interesting anecdotes, lots of interesting stories, but one still gets an impression you feel there is so much more to tell, so much more for you to share with the world, etc. Is there something that you think, there is something more that you could add, there is something more that you want to say?
I think the book, What Can I Give, captures not what makes him, not about his professional successes. It's not about what great missile he made, that everybody knows. Yeah. But what goes into making a person who can make those great missiles? So one of the things I asked once, what is your regret in life? And you've got achieved so much, you would have failed something. So what is amongst the many, many failures? He said, many, many failures. I said, which failure is the worst failure, which according to you, you still regret? Because most of the failures you overcome. And it's interesting what his biggest failure was. He said, my biggest failure was that in the later stages of life, my parents started losing vision. And back in those days in my house, there was a lot of power cut. I'm talking about 70s, 80s. Mm. And he said, they used to crash into stuff. Often you get injuries, small injuries, by falling or by crashing into something. He said, but I could not get them light. the gift of light.
But then, 27 July 2015, just go back to that day, IIM Shillong, when he was about to make a speech and he collapsed and we lost him. You were there in that moment. What sort of flashed into your mind when that happened? Was there in his conversations with you, there was some premonition of some sort in this?
48 hours before he passed away, we started for the first time, he talked about death. And he said, you know, the way to go away is that, and everybody has to go away. He said, the way to go away is to stand tall, wear your shoes, and do whatever you want to do. Whatever is the best thing you want to do. If you can just go away and leave the world at that particular moment, that's the best way to go. 27th July, when it happens, and I'm no more than a meter away when it happens. And, you know, I'm just typing something, which goes on his screen. And he's standing right here. And he pauses. So I start looking at him because I think that, you know, maybe the screen connection has gone away. And he just falls. And he doesn't fall like this. I mean, there's a picture of him falling like this, but that's not the final day picture. That's from some other event. He falls like this. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a loud thud. And then now I can see he's looking at me. His eyes are open. He's looking at me. And then he closes his eyes on his own. My initial reaction is he's fainted. And so we immediately go and pick him up. And then, you know, the reaction, at least in my part, is that you rub the palms, you know, hoping that the blood needs to be warmed. And then his hand just curled on me like this. And he had longer nails because he used to cut them only occasionally. And then I could just feel the nails. And then he just closed his eyes and straightened up on his own.
And never said anything.
Not a word. The last word he said was that the world of the youth of the world share common goals of eliminating poverty, pollution, and bringing prosperity to all. That was his last word. And then he paused, and that was it. And in that moment, when he falls, and then the doctor comes from IIM Shillong, and I say, let's take him to hospital immediately. And he said, well, it seems too late. And that's when I realized that, you know, he's no more there. He says, it's a massive cardiac arrest. And he had a mic on as a teacher. He loved to be a teacher. People asked him, what is the best thing, best profession you think you have done? And he said, not a missile man, not a space person, not a people's president. I want to be remembered as a teacher. And his last moment was actually teaching. And that's how he passed away.
He is responsible for India's major missile development. And I understand that he was once asked if he missed having children. And he said that I have three sons, Prithvi, Agni, and Brahmos. Now, in Brahmos, he, of course, had a very, very major role in development of the Brahmos system. Tell us a little bit more about it, because of late, in recent confrontations, Brahmos has played such an important role.
So, Brahmos has played an important role, especially in the arena of Operation Sindoor. So it's become a global battle-tested weapon. Now, the interesting part is that it's not just that Dr. Kalam had just a role to play in Brahmos. He was the person who signed Brahmos. He was the person who identified Brahmos and conceptualized it. And the story goes back in 1991, when the first Gulf War with Saddam Hussein versus George Bush Sr., that US versus Iraq, Kuwait invasion, there was a missile which is called Tomahawk missile.
The Tomahawks
were used extensively. And the world saw that these cruise missiles are going to change the front of the war. In 1990s, I'm talking about, just like today, drones we are talking about. Back then, it began. India had an aspiration that we should also now invest in cruise missiles. So Dr. Kalam, now this was a stock. This was a thought which was stuck in the head. Then he was visiting NPO in USSR, former USSR, mm-hmm. now Russia. And USSR had broken around the same point. So they didn't have anything, no resources to do anything more in terms of research. They were cutting down on research. So he was visiting a space rocket lab kind of a thing. And in the corner was lying a missile, an engine which was supposed to power rockets, not missiles. And the Russians said, when he said, what is this? The Russians said, well, this is an abandoned project. We don't have the money to do anything on this now. But this was supposed to be a ramjet. Ramjet is something which takes air from the atmosphere when it's moving. So it breathes air. Otherwise, sometimes you carry your own oxygen, your own air, so that you can mix it with fuel. But in this case, the oxygen is taken from the atmosphere itself when it's flying. So that ramjet was lying there. That ramjet became the basis. He said, no, I should use it somewhere. Now, these guys won't do anything about it. So what we can do is that we can collaborate with NPO and DRDO. So their NPO, our DRDO collaborated. And that's when the idea of BrahMos first struck in 1991. 1993, the engine was being processed upon. And then it took, then the Russian weapon lobby, they started opposing it.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, we should sell missiles to India rather than, India's making its own rockets and its own missiles.
Right.
So for 5 years, they opposed. And we secretly kept, this deal at the back of back channel, things kept happening. And it took 1998, 5 years, from 93 to 98, it took for the deal to be signed by Dr. Kalam himself. And then by 2001 in Chandipur, which is our test range, we tested BrahMos for the first time. BrahMos's guidance system was Indian. BrahMos's propulsion system was that wasted engine.
Russian
engine. And we didn't just match Tomahawk. Tomahawk flies at 0.7 Mach. BrahMos goes at 2.5 to 3 Mach. So BrahMos, it goes approximately 4 times faster than Tomahawk, has shorter range, but it's so fast that it's almost invisible. And we saw that in Operation
Sindhu.
Operation Sindhu. It's impossible to track BrahMos. And the beautiful thing is that over the past years and years, and especially in the last decade or so, we have tried to indigenize BrahMos as much as we can.
Now, one important event in Dr. Kalam's life was Pokhran 2. I mean, that changed the entire landscape as far as India's nuclear standing was concerned. And of course, the reaction was sanctions against India from where all, US, Japan, Europe, extensively, etc. But now we've come a full circle since then. Things. So how does one describe that? Does one describe that as a far-sighted thing that Dr. Kalam had, and of course supported by the rest of the government at that time? And how do you sort of look back and assess where we are today in terms of security, in terms of nuclear security?
So I think it was obviously the right move to make, and history has proven that. And the journey, sir, is a remarkable journey of Indian leaders across politics. So from Indira Gandhi, who did the first Pokhran, and that was very difficult in India, which was barely self-reliant in any way, was having the ambition to become nuclear. If you go even further, in 1950s, when Homi Bhabha first set out the Indian nuclear mission, that happened under Nehru. Then if you come, Narasimha Rao ji was the person Dr. Kalam often cited, that the project, the Pokhran 2 project, was essentially started by him. And they were about to test when the elections came. He lost the elections. And then very graciously, he said, and Dr. Kalam recalls this incident where Narasimha Rao ji made Dr. Kalam meet Atal Bihari ji and said, you take the ownership of the project, but this is a good project, you do it. Narasimha Rao is never featured. His name never comes in India's nuclear armed program. Nobody knows it. But he chose to be, he chose that I will be oblivious of all these things and let the current government take the whole credit. And Atalji was the person who said, okay, I will take. Everybody knew there will be sanctions. Everybody knew. But we said, okay, we have the political willpower to do it. And the way he went about it was fantastic. Now, what happened after that? Sanctions were there. We suffered a little bit. There was a war following that. The Kargil War also happened. Pakistan got it from China. That also happened.
They got from, yeah.
They got the whole blueprint from China.
Yeah, yeah.
So they basically smuggled a nuclear weapon. So they became, they're trying to match us. We went into plutonium path, which they are not yet. We went into the thermonuclear hydrogen bomb, which they don't have because the Chinese did not give them the hydrogen bomb. And very unilaterally, we said no first use. Pakistan never committed to no first use. China never committed to no first use. We were very clear that our program is a defensive, is a deterrence. So we will not be the first ones to use a nuclear weapon on anyone. But we also have deep underwater capability. We have submarine launch capability, which means our second use is guaranteed. So even if you destroy my silo, you don't know where my submarine is.
Let me talk about one interesting dichotomy. 2014, when we put the Mangalyaan into Mars orbit, right? There was a cartoon that was published in the New York Times. I suppose you remember
yes,
it.
Yes, the old
one. Indian farmer knocking on the door of the space club, right? This is a peculiar dichotomy that continues to exist in our life in every manner, in every form, at every level, etc. What's your reaction to this?
The farmer proved. The farmer didn't beg for anything. The farmer didn't ask for any dole outs. The farmer didn't ask for any extra consideration. The farmer was opposed, denied technology, and yet the farmer landed his Chandrayaan on the south pole of the moon before any of those elite clubs could. What does that cartoon show? It shows that the Western mindset, the white person's mindset, is that We are still a country of snake charmers and hungry people. I cannot preach the white man not to do this. My problem happens when we ourselves see ourselves in that frame. And, you know, we always tend to, whenever you go abroad, you know, Indians are the first people who compare, oh, this is so good, India is so bad. That mindset is a bigger problem. But what do I think about myself, that Macaulayism, a 200-year-old concept now, it's still surviving in our heads. We still feel that, you know, certain this Western language is better, Western culture is better, their scientific temperament is somehow better than ours when we were the ones who invented math and science.
That's right, absolutely.
And yet we feel that, you know, this whole Western construct is better. And we feel it because we were targeted as a society to feel that way. So this is the mindset change which needs to happen within our own minds. What the West thinks, whether the farmer is allowed in the space club or not, doesn't matter. The farmer smashed the door, you know, put his chair there,
and put his cow also there. I'm here as well.
And I'm here.
I'm here.
And now India, after India has also, you know, launched the maximum number of satellites in a single launch, beating its own record, has the alternative to GPS, is now going to Shukra, which is Venus now. We're going there. We are having a mission to set up our own international space stations, which Americans don't have after the ISS falls down in a 4 or 5 years or so. Americans don't have a plan right now. And we have a plan of Bharat Antariksh Station. We have a plan to land a human, an Indian human being on moon.
On the moon.
We have all the plans. And we are, if history is a proof of what future is, then our history proves that if we set our eyes on something, we get it.
Your Homi Labs is where you're reaching out to people. You're expanding the base for artificial intelligence. Two questions here. One, what is exactly being achieved there? And two, why are people still talking about India lagging behind, that India is slow to pick up on AI? These are very two important questions.
Right, so what's happening there, sir, I believe that AI has to be democratized. It's our way to leapfrog into the world of tomorrow. And to leapfrog into it, we have to be very innovative in how you build the human capacity to do so. So what we're doing right now is that we are building AI tools for basic human welfare. It has to be low cost. They have to be integrated into the governance systems. We are training people. We're the largest in Hindi. We are the world's biggest training, 2.5 crore almost hours of training we have imparted, as I told you, in AI, which is a phenomenal achievement of its own kind. And I believe that children and teachers of those children have to be trained. Now, coming to the second part of your question, sir, you know, about where we stand on AI. So in the hardware layer, I think we have started taking that bus now. We've just, you know, setting up 13 their semiconductor projects, which have been green-lighted. There are international collaborations we are doing. And I'm talking about just 2026, what is being doing. We sort of started this not, you know, more, maybe about 6 or 9 months ago only. But the progress has been promising. I'm not saying we are still anywhere near China, Taiwan or USA, but we are at least having the right aspiration and we are putting the right investments, and private sector is taking some leadership. The second layer which we talked about was in terms of the model. This is the weakest layer right now for us. We are, so example, you know, Sarvam, recently you might have heard there was a huge investment in a company called Sarvam AI.
That's right.
Now, that is the model layer we're talking about. But this is like, now it's happening. Then let's come to the third layer, application layer. We're good at that. We are building a lot of applications which are based on AI. They are good users now. ChatGPT is very well used, so you also got the users. Fourth layer is the human layer, the talent layer. Talent layer, we can do remarkably well because the Indian mind understands algorithm better than any other mind does. Then comes the policy layer, which wraps around all of this. One thing is that, of course, we were slightly slow in terms of semiconductor, and we must admit and we must make amends for it. The second thing is that sometimes
I feel... What's held us back there?
So we didn't see that, you know, this is something which will explode exponentially. We didn't see that GPUs, for instance, will suddenly explode as a demand. And the private sector has to be brought into the picture well ahead, not at the last moment. The problem of the model layer has to be solved from the policy layer. The problem is, sir, here that while IITs are great, but we are over-relying on a single frame of institution, the IITs. We want IITs to do everything. And that is like putting all your eggs in one basket. And this is not a risk you want to take. If you look at what's happening in the West, most of the AI research is being done and companies are done by commercial companies. Because this is not a research project anymore. This is a commercially highly aggressive project. So in such a rapidly changing world, it cannot be just a research project. It can be part of it is research, but part of it is rapid deployment and development and re-engineering. And that aggression has to come from smaller private sector organizations, which has happened in the West. So we have to shift our policy focus from higher education institutions, and particularly IITs, to more institutions of higher education, so there's competition, and in the private sector, the enterprise sector. That is where, sir, I think the policy challenge we need to solve.
But on the larger scale, where would you assess our digital performance?
So there are goods to it, which I've already told you. Things like, if all gram panchayats are connected with fiber optics, that's great. But one-fourth or less than one-fourth of rural households have internet. That's something lacking. We have internet wires going to villages, but we do not have the internet literacy for people to use internet in a meaningful way. It's great that, so many UPI transactions are happening. Some of them are happening also from rural areas. Some of them are also done by people who are not so well educated. But our bus does not stop at the destination of just because people are making payments on a UPI platform. Mm-hmm. That is not our end goal. That's a goal to have. But that's not the end goal. We can't, keep harping on this, that this happens in India, so we are now so digitally connected. Yes, we are. But there's much more to do today on internet and on digital media and on internet-based tools than just making payments. People can learn so much. People can teach so much. People can sell to each other. People can sell outside India. So I think, sir, we need to have our aspirations for a digital India much higher than just UPI. And sir, in a changing time with AI, cybersecurity will become a huge issue. So while we are bringing in more people,
right. We
also have to secure them. You have to secure digital persona. That is happening in AI. So today, even in a news channel, it's so difficult to find whether a video is AI generated or not. Now imagine what will happen to a common man. How does he know or she know that this may be AI generated? So that digital awareness, digital protection of rights, and cybersecurity will also play a massive role in the future digital arena of India.
Now, one last question. Come back to a dichotomy. Come back to our having, we sit around 130th position as far as Human Development Index is concerned. And yet we have this vast picture of these wonderful things that we've achieved as a country. Why are we still stuck at 130 in the Human Development Index?
So that's an excellent question, which has a very deep insight and empathy to it. We have grown in certain sectors remarkably well. Space, defense, IT. We have been lacking in still providing basic amenities in many sectors. Healthcare. Today, barring a few states, if you go to a government hospital, it's not a petty sight at all. It's a sight of desperation. Today, if an IAS officer's child goes to a government school, it appears on the front page of a newspaper as if it's a huge sacrifice he has made. He's sacrificed the future of his child. And I'm like, why should that be? Why is an officer's child going to a government school considered to be a newsworthy topic, which means that the government schools are in a way condemned out? So we have not, certain sectors we have done well, certain sectors we have either not gone in the right direction, or sometimes we feel that the focus is still lacking. We don't see the urgency of that. There is nothing wrong in India rising and becoming rich. It's a great thing. India should have rich people. Eventually, we will hope that, these will pull more and more people out of poverty. Now, China, by all accounts, is not the best example in terms of society, but in terms of pulling people out of poverty, their examples are quite well. They have ensured that the fruits of the export growth does go to the rural level, and they have set records in pulling people out of poverty. I feel that being, amongst the top economies in the world is our capability. And improving our HDI is our conscience. And this conscience and capability have to be brought together. But we need to be more innovative. As Dr. Kalam used to say that you have to leapfrog. You can't copy the Western model. They have a different society. You can be a Singapore, but not by the Singapore path. We cannot be rich for the last mile man or last mile woman if we're not energy secure. And the path to energy security is not through oil, through not even ethanol, nothing. The path to energy security is in the shores of Kerala and Odisha. If you see the sands, there are those black patterns. Those black patterns are basically ores of thorium. They have to scoop it. You don't have to dig it. India's thorium, India controls about 1/3 of global thorium, 1/4 to 1/3 of global thorium. And the energy of thorium in the world is right now more than the combined energy of uranium, petrol, oil, coal of the world. And we're not doing that much as we should. We're now, and this was, I'm not saying this, this was said by Homi Bhabha in 1950s. The first thing I'll do before anything else, before having lunch, is to dig into that gold mine. And I think we're sitting on
and
this.
And that's the gold mine.
It's right there. The monazite, it's the ore of thorium. It's right there, those dark bands. If you ever fly over Kerala or Odisha, you'll see them. And it's just there.
Well, I'll certainly look out for it next time when I fly. Thank you very much, Srijan.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful hearing all this with you.
Thanks.